Welcome to Life and Sirens, Behind and On the Scene, a podcast by First Responders. We're your hosts, Sophie,
Jamie,
and Aubrey.
The content provided in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any medical institutions, emergency medical services, or healthcare organizations. Patient privacy is a top priority, and all discussions involving real-world emergency situations are de-identified and altered to ensure confidentiality. Always consult with a qualified healthcare professional or your local EMS protocols before making any decisions regarding patient care or medical practices. Listener discretion is advised, as some topics may include discussions of real-world emergency situations.
Welcome to another episode of Life and Sirens. Today we have another Radio Report listener tale for you guys. So this one's going to be from Steven. He's located in Texas in the U.S. of A. He wrote us a very cool story. Outlines a call that he went on, and then at the end he's kind of asking some questions about the call. So we're just going to read you what he wrote us, and then we're going to kind of dissect it, go through his questions, and see if we can possibly answer those.
Let's do it.
It's very long, so Soph, do you want to start off with the first little block?
Sure.
Big block?
All right. Here we go. We have a lot of 5-plus story apartment complexes. Sometimes they only have one or two elevators in different locations for the entire building. This oftentimes delays patient contact time depending where the elevator is to that apartment. We were requested by PD saying they were doing a welfare check and wanted medics to respond for a possible DOA. Further information stated an apartment with emails. Jeez, that's so sorry. With mail stacked outside the door. When we arrived, I told engine crew to just load the stretcher as if they were going to work a code, even though this sounded like a DOA. Normally, if it's critical call, and we send the medic crew up the stairs with the monitor and the jump bag, but because the information provided, we decided to all take the elevator. I feel like that's always a red flag, but if as we continue, you'll see it's not the red flag that you think it's going to be. While we're waiting for the elevator, a PD officer popped out of the stairwell and said, "Over here, he's still breathing!" That's exactly how he sounded.
Dun, dun.
I told my partner to follow him up with the monitor, and I'll be right behind with the jump bag. Two off the engine will take the stretcher and the rest of the equipment up the elevator. Soon as I entered the stairwell, I didn't see my partner or the officer and was confused, expecting to see them running up the stairs. I turned to the engine officer and said, "Fourth floor, right?" He said, "Yes, I'll go with you. I have the map." We can count on fire to always have the map.
Oh yeah, map.
We like it. Where's the map? Where's the map?
I was about to say, Dora the Explorer.
So we ran up the stairs to the fourth floor, made it into the apartment, and I heard an officer yell, "Is that the medics over here? Help!" It's in all caps, so I feel like it's how I have to say it.
Absolutely.
So I'm expecting to run into my partner. Instead, it was a different officer kneeling next to an unconscious male in his 70s. That's never a good sign. I look at the engine officer and ask him, "Where the hell is my partner with the monitor?" So the engine officer turned around and left, which instead I should have just asked him to come help me because at this point he left to go find my partner, leaving me alone.
We've all made that mistake.
Yeah.
You'll only do it a couple times. Patient was supine, unresponsive, with dry vomit around him and his face. Dry urine on the floor, no obvious injuries or anything that stood out from a quick head to toe. Inside the airway had dry vomit and respirations were about 10, but I didn't see any signs of cyanosis. I went ahead and put him on high flow, non-rebreather. I had a difficult time feeling a radial pulse, but his carotid felt regular, about 90 beats per minute. Attempted to obtain a manual blood pressure. I could not hear it for the life of me, but saw pulsing between 60 or 70.
Ooh, 60 palp. No bueno.
Yeah, big red flags everywhere. While I was pulling out IV equipment, the engine crew finally arrived, but still no partner or monitor. Where the heck is your partner, bro?
Oh my gosh.
Is he okay?
The partner followed a popo, so.
Yeah.
We've also all made that mistake.
They lost together.
I directed one to work on clearing the airway with suction, one to obtain manual vitals, and the other to obtain IV access. One to look for any meds around the apartment while I started drawing up push dose, epi, and fluids. Initial manual set of vitals was a BP that we were unable to obtain. Pulse was 90 carotid, respirations 10, lung sounds wet, upper fields, possibly from aspiration being found supine in this position. Blood glucose was 180. Pupils were reactive.
All right.
A lot going on here.
A lot.
We were able to establish bilateral IVs, started fluids at 250 ml boluses at a time, monitoring lung sounds, and 10 microgram epi push dose. After our second push dose, about 2 to 3 minutes apart, we obtained a manual blood pressure of 70 over 40. Improvement. Finally,
whoa,
the monitor arrived. My partner and the PD officer were drenched in sweat. The PD officer. Apparently, when the PD officer took my partner, they stayed on the first floor, which is why when I entered the stairwell, I didn't see them going up the stairs, and took him to the opposite side of the building, ran up the stairwell to the fourth floor, and then had to run back to where the apartment was located.
Oh, my heavens.
Vitals reobtained with monitor that we have now gotten. Blood pressure, 80 over 60. Pulse, 98. Respirations, 8 to 10. SpO2, 100%. End-tidal CO2, 20. 12 leads showing a sinus rhythm with occasional PVCs. Treatment so far. Normal saline, 250 milliliter bolus, 2 10 microgram epi pushes, O2 nasal cannula, and non-rebreather high flow.
That end title.
Right? I don't love that end title.
Gulp.
Mm-hmm. At this point, we were on scene for about 20 minutes. The plan was to RSI before we got going. I decided to give one more push dose and reassess blood pressure. Blood pressure had minimal improvement to 85 over 60. Told the crew, continue the fluid. Let's get down to the medic. Oh my gosh. Let's get down to the medic.
Yeah. I think that's their truck.
Their truck.
Yeah.
I think that's cute.
Let's get down to the medic. And I'll get him on the pump with epi. Ooh, fancy. On the way to the medic. I can't. On the way to the truck. We did another 10 microgram epi push dose. What is that for now?
Yeah.
And received a total of 500 to 600 mLs of normal saline. Once we got him loaded in the unit, patient's blood pressure improved to 90 over 70. Started the pump with epi at 6 mics a minute. Started transport. Nearest hospital was less than 10 minutes away. Asked for riders, so it was a total of 3 of us in the back of the ambulance. About halfway through the transport, our blood pressure improved to 110 over 70. Asked the crew in the back with me if they wanted RSI or we could continue transport. Crew all decided that they thought RSI was the best option. Directed the driver to pull over, used ketamine and rock, quickly got the tube, and continued transport. Vital signs at arrival facility, blood pressure 100 over 70, pulse 98 to 100, respiratory rate manually ventilated with VVM, so hopefully like 12, SpO2 100%, end tidal 40. All right, bet. ED diagnosis was respiratory failure and admitted. Ops, you want to go?
So this is what Stephen wrote. He said, a few points brought up after this call. One of the engine rookies asked why I didn't want to bag the patient when his respiratory rate was low. My answer, I knew I wanted to RSI this patient. I typically avoid pre-oxygenating with a BVM or oral adjuncts because the possibility of a gag reflex or bagging for a long period of time and possibly causing the patient to vomit. If the patient is able to oxygenate well with a non-rebreather and high-flow nasal cannula, and they can maintain an SpO2 of greater than 94, no signs of cyanosis, I'll continue with that.
I mean, I think I agree with that.
Yeah, I think that the thought process is
sound
solid. Yeah, you don't want to throw in an oral adjunct because you're just not sure about your gag reflex. That does not mean that an NPA is not an option at that point,
yeah.
So I would probably consider an NPA as a good adjunct. But to his point, the patient's oxygenating well.
Yeah.
No signs of cyanosis. I would say that clearly we vomited, so we're most likely aspirated, which they already decided that was probably the case.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm on board.
Yeah.
No BVM at that point.
I also think that another thing to look at is not just respiratory rate. It's not just, like, work of breathing. It's what kind of tidal volume am I getting? Because if our respiratory rate is low, but I'm taking deep breaths, like, our tidal volume is still good.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's how much we're going to bag someone in a cardiac arrest.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
Yeah.
That's definitely adequate.
Yeah.
And I think that tidal volume plus rate is minute ventilation.
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
As long as we're reaching the right goal, I think that he's correct to, like, hang out without the BVM at that point.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this is also how you can kind of identify a provider who has seen a thing or two. Mm-hmm. Because we're not just doing, like, rote. We're going to follow the algorithm. We have, like, every patient, especially the critically ill patients, are complex. It's not just like, oh, they're bradycardic. Let's move down the algorithm. There's way more to it than that.
For sure.
Absolutely.
And just because they don't need to be ventilated with a BVM does not mean that they can maintain their airway well.
Exactly. He so clearly, like, was not doing a great job.
Yeah. So RSI can still be warranted even without needing to ventilate via BVM. Because without mentation improvement, like, that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, I think this person earned their tube.
His second question is, why would I give fluids when his lung sounds were wet? My answer was, that's why I did 250 boluses at a time and reassessed lung sounds in between each bolus. I had assigned a medic to monitor that throughout the whole call.
He assigned a truck to monitor that?
I love that. I think it's so funny.
This one is the human form,
I
believe.
Got it.
I assigned a medic to monitor that throughout the whole call. I did not listen to lung sounds prior to ED arrival. I believed what that medic was telling me. He said it sounded clear with minimal rails, which tells me the initial lung sounds of wet / rails was possibly from the fluid that was still in his mouth, and it had just sounded like it was wet in his lungs. By the time we arrived at the ED, he had received a whole bag of saline.
I think that is appropriate. Mm-hmm. I mean, this gentleman has been down for an unknown amount of time, and I think it context clues, right?
Right, and at some point you're kind of going with, like, the lesser of two evils. Yeah. So I am concerned with wet lung sounds. I don't want to fluid overload this person, but something that you learn about in both medic school and maybe critical care school is that wet lung sounds don't always mean that the patient is not fluid down. So they can still be fluid down and be third spacing fluid.
Well, I would say even if, like, I would say we're not assuming this patient is in pulmonary edema or not having some kind of flash pulmonary,
a dried,
like, pathology.
Vomit is not indicative of, like a flash pathology.
So I think you can have wet lung sounds with, you know, aspiration pneumonia for sure.
For sure. And I like that he pointed out, like, initially when we listened to lung sounds, there was vomit, like, in his mouth and in his throat. Like, he clearly wasn't controlling secretions. And sometimes they can sound like they're somewhere else.
Oh, yeah.
Like, think about where you are. They're, like, in this guy's floor. Like, it is hard sometimes to identify where the sounds are coming from.
Yes, and there's a lot of yucky things happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of things can change from your initial. Once you reposition the patient and kind of get in a better spot, sometimes your secondary assessment will significantly improve.
Hopefully it does.
Yeah. That's the goal, right?
That is the goal.
Right. All right. What's our next question?
Our next question is, somebody pointed out, why did he choose Epi over Levo? And he says, I really did not have an answer. I typically use Levo for tachy patients like septic shock. I really didn't have much thought when I asked for the push dose, for the Epi push dose. His heart rate was below 100, but during transport, we did notice that he had some PVC increase. So maybe it would have been a better option.
I also think that that's a fantastic observation.
Yeah.
I think that Levo would have been perfectly appropriate.
I do too.
But Epi is not inappropriate at that point.
Provider judgment.
For sure. And I like that at the end, he was like, we actually did have a PVC frequency increase. Mm-hmm. So it could have been better. The only reason that I maybe would have innately gone for Levo is because you really had an unknown etiology of this patient's down reason.
I agree with them.
And you don't want to aggravate anything that you have not yet figured out exists.
Yeah.
And Levo is a bit more benign.
And with this unknown downtime, like, we could just be, like, decompensating to the point, like, well, now we're not tachycardic because we're headed in the opposite direction. We're not bradycardic yet, but, like, we're going that way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely don't think Epi's inappropriate.
No,
definitely not. But I love that you pointed out, like, that you typically think of Levo for, like, super tachy patients, right? Because it doesn't have all of the inotropic effects that just Epi has, which I think is great.
For sure.
It sounds like you really thought through this call.
I think that you're just on top
of it. I'm not sure what more
we
can add to this, but I think you did a great job.
If you ever consider moving to Tennessee, my friend.
Yeah, hit us up.
Hit us up.
Come on.
Or just hit us up for fun and more stories.
Yeah, except for don't bring that one popo that ran your partner all through the place with the monitor.
Yeah, I don't have the stamina
for
that, so.
Absolutely not. Y'all would have found me down on the other side of that floor.
Oh, yeah. I would have been out for the count. So, Stephen's closing remarks. He says, thanks for reading this call. If you have any critiques or what other treatment / management that you would have done for this patient, that would be greatly appreciated. One thing that confused me was the initial end tidal reading at 20. Kind of started to lead us down a sepsis path, but I didn't know if it was a false reading because with the non-rebreather and nasal cannula at high flow, and once we got the tube, it was reading 35 to 45.
Ooh.
Which I love this.
Yeah.
Because we are entitled fanatics.
Yeah.
We love it.
Or, you know, you could call us entitled psychopaths.
Yeah, either one.
Yeah, whichever vibe.
I'd put it both on a sticker, to be honest.
Honestly, entitled psychopaths really. I'm vibing with that one today.
I think that is really more all encompassing.
I genuinely feel like there is so much going on here that I don't know. I love entitled, and I think it's a great tool. I just don't know that this is going to point us in any specific direction because we have no idea and there's everything that could possibly go wrong.
Also consider your flow rate. So your entitle reads on your expiration. If you have a non-rebreather and a nasal cannula going, they're both on like decently high flow.
Yeah.
You could have like a washout situation where it's just not able to read
the
actual exhaled gas well, depending on what piece of equipment you have. And I'm curious if the end tidal was 35 to 40 immediately after the intubation or after ventilating for
a while.
Yeah,
like what was our trend?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I also think, like, this end tidal, like, you talk about low end tidal in sepsis patients for, like, in regards to, like, perfusion status or, like, hypotensive patients in low end tidal. We have no idea how long his lungs have been getting this sick for. Mm-hmm. So he could have had a low end tidal and super sepsis-y vibes. And now, again, just like the tachycardia headed, you know, towards bradycardia, we're also headed in the opposite direction now because we're just that far down. We've added other chaos into the mix as far as what could potentially be wrong with this patient.
Ooh, also, what was his blood pressure when they got an entitle of 20?
That's what I was going to say. I think...
Yeah, it was like 60.
All of... Yeah, everything that we've talked about is all of what you typically think with entitle, right? You're thinking about like a sepsis pathology. You always think about respiratory when you're using entitle. But what it is like at its core is just a measurement of perfusion, right? So if you have a blood pressure of 60, you are not perfusing well at that time. So your entitle is going to read low. So it could be something just as simple as that. Once you had done the push-dose pressors, you got them on an epi drip, you got that blood pressure up, and that at that point is when you RSI'd, you were able to get an established airway and saw an improvement in end tidal. It could be something just as simple as that.
Yeah, end tidal made decent sense to me, but it was a conversation that Aubrey and I, actually it might have been all three of us had, and you guys really were explaining to me, like, okay, where does CO2 come from? And I was like, the periphery. And you were like, absolutely. What takes it to the lungs? And I was like, blood. And you said, great. What isn't happening when people are hypotensive? And I was like, oh, yeah, the blood, no go back.
No go round.
And they'll go round, right? And I was just like, yeah, that's why your end tidal's low. And because my brain only could think of it in a respiratory drive. I could only think of it as like low hyperventilation. Like,
yeah.
That's the only place my brain could go. And yeah, when you were just like, your body literally just can't take the CO2 to the lungs, which is why it's low when you exhale. And that just, I don't know why it took that very specific conversation for it to click.
Thank you for explaining that. I think people need to hear it like that.
Right. Yeah. It helps with understanding perfusion status, because then you're like, oh, that's why a hypotensive patient, whether it's hypovolemia or just hypotension based on their medical condition, will have a low end tidal.
I think right now, with medic students, I realized that, like, when you're in school or fresh out of school, typically you just see end tidal in a respiratory way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And think about it. Think about it, if most of your experience with any kind of higher level of, like, patient monitoring is in an ER, what are they going to do instead of end tidal?
Colorimetric.
Right, colorimetric, but instead of getting someone's like end tidal with a nasal cannula,
blood gas,
they're going to get an ABG, right, or a VBG. But they're oftentimes only going to do that in specific patient populations.
Yeah,
like
because getting an ABG is kind of a pain.
Yeah, their first inclination on a trauma is not going to be like, let's get an ABG right now.
Yeah.
But if you throw them on end tidal, you're going to see it low, especially if you're suspicious that they're like hemorrhaging somewhere internally.
Yeah, there could be anything with this man.
Yeah.
I think the situation that made this all make so much sense to me was actually a call that me and Soph ran. It was a GSW, young person, had a significant wound to a significant region of the body, And we had initially, put him in on end title, had a normal reading, it was like 35 probably.
Oh yeah, it did.
And as the blood pressure would trend down, we could watch the end title trend down, like perfectly in sync with it. And it wasn't until that call that I was like, oh,
yeah,
it's perfusion.
And we talked about it. It wasn't like significantly, like he wasn't like profoundly hypotensive.
It was so sensitive to it though.
I know we talk, especially he's like otherwise healthy, right? We talked about this because in our service, it's almost, and it's becoming less taboo, but it's almost like taboo to fly people.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I know he needed blood. There was nothing else I could do. This man needed blood. And unfortunately, we don't have access to that on our ground 911. I would have had to divert. I don't think that's appropriate. I think he needed to go to the trauma center as quickly as possible to save as much bowel as possible.
For sure.
And I was like, I am flying him for blood.
Absolutely.
I'm flying him for blood. And I think that was fine.
We tend to think that they have to be altered or like has to be really like RSI.
Unresponsive. Like, yeah.
Yeah, they've got to be intubated or RSI.
And like that's our service. I know that's not.
Yeah, and we are like a rural-urban mix. And so at some places, you're 15 minutes from the trauma center, like right at our county line. But then you can be on the opposite end of the county line, and you're an hour.
Yeah, it's definitely.
So it really depends.
Steven, that's kind of the vibe you're getting. I feel like you, I feel like you did everything you should have done.
Absolutely.
I feel like someone's giving you a hard time for it.
I think that the biggest question that he's probably been asked, or maybe not, but is why did you stop to RSI? Like they said there were 10 minutes from the facility. Why did we pull over to RSI once our blood pressure was like at a decent spot to be able to RSI them?
Because it was clinically indicated.
You know what I counter you with?
All right, what?
I commend him for resuscitating before he intubated.
He did resuscitate 100%. Before he intubated.
I think that that's huge.
Proud of you.
Yeah, he saw an opportunity during transport when he was still with this patient where he managed to get this patient hemodynamically stable enough to be able to secure an airway. Because that was one of the first things that he mentioned was like, I know that this man needs an airway.
Yeah.
We're just not there yet, and that's okay. We're going to do our initial ABCs, focus on the C's, and then we're going to circle back. And I think that that is fantastic.
You know, now that I'm reflecting on this, you know how he says, once we got him loaded into the medic unit, patient's blood pressure improved, and he got received a total of 500 to 600 of saline. But prior to him administering any fluid boluses, even with, what did he say, 3 doses of push-dose epi, it did not improve. That makes me feel like this patient is volume down.
100%.
Oh, yeah.
So that's all. Maybe the only thing that I would have done a little differently is maybe just been a little more aggressive with the fluid resuscitation.
Yeah, a little more liberal with the fluid and maybe waited a bit between the push doses of epi.
Yeah, and I think the epi is appropriate, but I think that he was trying to focus a little bit more on, like, we have wet lung sounds.
For sure.
And I think that is a distracting sign or symptom.
Yeah.
But I truly think in this case that it was just maybe aspiration pneumonia type route.
Right, because it's responsible to say, like, I have wet lung sounds. I want to be
absolutely
cautious with my fluid resuscitation. But sometimes if you pay attention, like, also mind you, there's like 3,000 things you're responsible for.
Hindsight is absolutely 2020.
Yes. And so if like, clearly he did break this patient down very, very well. And I'm sure later he was like, oh, it does not match like flash pathology.
Yeah.
And so looking at this patient, he's like, oh, yeah, I definitely shouldn't have been as concerned with fluid. But in the moment, you're like, I don't want to do anything to make it worse. I think that what could have been really cool, also hindsight's 2020. You just don't have the time to sit here and do what we're doing right now. But what could have been cool is after a couple of those push doses of epi, like clearly we've got some catecholamines on board now. Maybe then do a levo drip.
Yeah.
So add on your second pressor.
I think that's.
We don't necessarily have to stay with the same one again because we don't know the etiology of his downtime.
Yeah.
So add levo in your drip and stick with your push dose epi and kind of see where you get yourself.
Right. And it wasn't.
I think could have been an option.
Yeah. Improving in a significant way. So I think that it's fair to maybe try another one.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's why we're talking about this. And I appreciate Steven's humility in sharing this and, you know, being like, here's what happened. Yeah. What do you think? And I think that's how we all get better.
Right.
Absolutely.
And this is the coolest part about medicine because we've just talked about 3 different ways that you could have treated this patient, all of which would have had a positive outcome.
Yes, and that's why I love paramedicine.
Yeah.
Like, I love it.
You stopped to RSI him. You got that airway. It was appropriate.
Yeah.
You managed his ventilatory status. You could have also not stopped, gone to the facility. They would have probably RSI'd him, managed his ventilatory status.
Yes.
And based off of the O2 sats we were reporting, he was actually oxygenating well.
Yeah.
So he would have been okay. Was our airway protected? No, which is why I think stopping and RSI'ing him was a good idea.
I do too.
I think that I like when you said, like, that's the clinical course. Mm-hmm. I like that. But also, if you were like, no, let's just hit it, you also wouldn't have been wrong.
Yeah.
If you would have added a pressor, you wouldn't have been wrong. If you would have been more aggressive in fluid, you wouldn't have been wrong. If you would have been less aggressive in fluid, you also probably wouldn't have been wrong.
Yeah.
I just think it's really cool that you can have a bunch of different, like,
ways
small
to get
changes
to the right answer.
To get to the end. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I think that everything went like it should have. I probably would have stopped as well.
Yeah.
Or at least RSI'd in route. I am a big proponent of, just because the hospital is going to do it when we get there doesn't mean we can't.
Yeah.
Like, sure. I mean, you can. Like you said, you can absolutely wait. And I think you're already en route. It's an acceptable choice.
Yeah.
But, like, just because they're going to do it doesn't mean you can't do it on the way.
I also think that we talk a lot about, we hear a lot in our region, I don't know about anybody else, but we don't do things just because the hospital does things.
Mm-hmm.
And that argument bothers me so much, because if every facet of medicine operated that way, it'd be a disaster.
Yes.
If your PCP was like, hey, I'm actually not going to control your hypertension because the ER will when you have to go there.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. If the ER is like, hey, we're actually not going to place a Foley because the ICU will do that. You know, we're not going to start your pressor because the ICU will do that.
Yeah.
Like, when you start transitioning it into other forms of medicine, it starts to sound ridiculous. And I think that for EMS, when we're like, oh, I'm not going to start an IV, the hospital will, which is your definitive care, which is your course of treatment, but I'm not going to do it. It bothers me that we separate ourselves that way. Mm-hmm. When, like, anything that can expedite this patient's care in their best interest is a good idea.
That's part of our job, is to expedite patient care to, like, I think people who have the ideology that we shouldn't be doing things that the ER is going to just do are the kind of people who think that we're just, like, we should only be intervening if there's an intervention that's going to stop them from dying right this second.
Yeah. And we're just not.
I don't believe in that.
Yeah, and that's just not what EMS is anymore.
Yeah. Y'all are too smart to think like that.
Right?
There's so many fun things we can do to help people.
Yeah, be cool.
Have fun.
Do things. Yeah. Use your brain. Like Steven.
Yeah,
like
Steven.
I'm a big fan.
Me too.
Me too.
Send us more.
Come hang out. Yeah, send us more stories.
Yeah, I want to know more about your calls and what the sweet engine boys asked you about them.
Yeah, and if I've never heard anyone call the EMS unit or the truck
the medic.
I like it. Is that like standard in your state or your region or your service?
Right. I also want to know why the engine officer does not give his map to the popo officer. I need him to share maps.
He was on a delay.
Mm-hmm. Dora's backpack only had one map.
Yeah,
he said, I will not be giving up this map. This is my map.
This is my map.
I came prepared. You didn't.
Yeah,
you have to suffer.
You are lost.
Well, thanks, Steven, and we will talk soon, hopefully, and we'll be doing more of this model. We already have another radio report submission that we're going to do soon that is a dynamic call as well. So go forth, prosper, and put patients on Entitle.
Yeah.
And tell us about it.
And then tell us about it. Entitle.
And scene.
This has been Life and Sirens, produced by three nerds trying to bring you content that you might actually care about.